Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Sean from Yonkers, New York, and his home group is Pathway to Power.
My name's Sean O'Connor. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sean.
Who doesn't know how to work a microphone? off to a great start so far.
Here we go.
No. So, I'm from Yonkers, Pathway to Power. We meet Wednesdays and Saturdays at 8:15. We're a big book step and a big book study meeting. I don't know if any of you guys travel to Yonkers regularly, but, you know, I don't know why you would either. But this is a whole lot different than what we are used to. But if for some reason you're going to Manhattan or something for the night and you make a wrong turn and get lost, come check us out. We'd be more than welcome to have you. So what's my story? I have me and my buddy Dermot. Thank you for coming up, Dermot. You know you're not working with enough new people when you can't get people to come with you on outgoings because they have jobs. You know, like I called a bunch of people today, like, hey, you want to come to Quakertown, Pennsylvania with me? And they're like, I kind of got to work during the day. Like, man, you know, when I was working with new people every single day, there'd be a ton of guys that could come. And I've been slacking on that, partly because of work, partly because of just getting complacent in my recovery. But a little bit about my story. A lot of times you hear people come up here and talk about, like, this horrific, horrific life, this childhood that, like, by the end of it, I'm like, yeah, I would be drinking too still. That's not my story. You know, I used to get jealous of the people that would have, like, these horrible upbringings and have, like, these crazy stories that can get at the podium and tell, and everyone feels bad for them. I grew up in a really small town in Yonkers. It's Crestwood, New York, and I had a great childhood. I really did. Everything in my childhood was what you would draw up. I had two parents that cared for me endlessly. I had siblings that would do anything for me. But there was always something about me that never fit in with everything else that was going on. You know, I was telling this example the other day. I would look at pictures of, like, our childhood, and there'd be, like, my three siblings standing, like, in a row together, like Brady Bunch-esque. And then there'd be me, like, off to the side. Like, no idea what's going on with the picture. No idea what's going on in the world. Just this total disconnection to everyone else. And it was so confusing. Like, I didn't know what it was. I had absolutely no idea what that was. And that's not, like, in the middle of my alcoholism. That's, like, from the get-go. Like, from day one, there was something about me that made me feel different than every single other person. Even the people that cared the most about me. Like, I don't understand that. Like, that makes no sense. And what happened was I kept going through grammar school and, like, doing what kids do. Like, my job was to be in seventh grade, go to school, get decent grades, and, like, play basketball. But I was so uncomfortable with who I was that, like, it was like they were asking the world of me. Like, how do you expect me to do this? I'm 13 years old. I have a lot going on right now. I can't do all these things. And what happened was on my 13th birthday, I had a party with all my friends and we're hanging out in my basement. You know, typical 13-year-old birthday party. Except I noticed that there was a fridge in my basement that was full of beers. And it's like, why not? You know, why not have that first drink with a group of friends, you know, group of 13-year-old kids? And we cracked open these first beers. And I didn't have that allergy kick off right away. Like, some people say from the first time they drank, it was like this greatest experience ever. And that, like, you know, 4 weeks later, they're in detox and they're ready to get sober. That's not my story. I had like three beers max. There was no allergy getting kicked off, none of that. But what had happened was people were talking about me. People were like, wow, this kid's throwing a party where his parents are home and drinking beers with his friends. But during that party, I'm not like one of those really smart, conniving, manipulative alcoholics. When I did things that were wrong, I usually got caught really quickly. And I did not think to drink through at all here. I had these beers and just put the empty beer cans right back into the refrigerator. I was like, no one will ever know what happened. Like, I'm good. I got this. And the next day, I came home from, like, being out for a little bit. And, like, my mom had that look on her face. I don't know if any of you guys have seen that look on a parent's face. But, like, I've seen anger a lot. Like, I knew what anger was. But this wasn't really anger. It was more just, like, shame, maybe. Maybe it was shame or, like, embarrassment. And she was just like, are you kidding me? She's like, you drank at this 13-year-old birthday party with all your friends. And not only did you drink, you had absolutely no game plan on how to get rid of the empty beer cans. I was like, Mom, like, I didn't know what to do. She's like, you probably could have, like, stepped on them and crushed them up and thrown them out. Like, you could have done whatever. Anything besides what you did. And, like, to this day, I swear, she was much more disappointed in me in the fact that I couldn't come up with, like, a plausible out than that I was drinking at the 13-year-old birthday party and she had to call the parents and tell her, hey, so Sean had that birthday party. They were drinking at it. You know, like, she was much more upset, and she knew, like, this is going to be the one. Like, this is going to be the one that's going to do dumb things and who's going to get in trouble for it. And so I got grounded for a month, which the truth is, like, totally worth it. Absolutely worth it. Alcohol and the ramifications for it were always worth it for me. I wasn't one of those guys who thought it was going to be different the next time. I didn't. You know, I do think the true definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, knowing full well what's going to happen. And being like, all right, let's do it. Like, it beat sobriety. And that's why I kept doing it, because I hated being sober. Like, that's why I drank, because sobriety was terrible for me. Like, I didn't like who I was. I didn't like how I felt. I didn't like the person I was becoming at all. And alcohol kind of worked for a long time. And so I get grounded for this month. And they're like, all right, like, I'm done with this. And my older brother's like, you want to go out for a little bit? And I'm like, all right, you know, I'll go out with him. And my parents, who, like, really tried hard, they gave me a strong curfew when I was going out with kids my age, because they were clearly the problem. And when I was going out with my older brother, I had no curfew at all. But the kids my age aren't drinking at all because they're 13. And my older brother and his 17 and 18-year-old friends are drinking all the time, and I want to fit in with them. You know, I want to fit in with them. I'll do whatever it takes to fit in with anybody. I still suffer from that. And we go out to this park, and I throw one back. And it was like I drank it quick, and it felt good. Alcohol really started to work that day. And I don't think it was the allergy that got kicked off in me right away. I drank a lot more than I should have. But I do believe it was the obsession to fit in that kicked off. And alcohol was what was working. I think the allergy developed over time. But I think that obsession to fit in was going strong that day. And after like 3 or 4 beers, being a 13-year-old 7th grader, my older brother takes me to the side. He's like, Sean, you need to be very careful with this stuff. His grandpa died as an alcoholic. I'm sitting there, 13 years old. I've probably had 6 beers in my entire life. And I have absolutely no idea what he's talking about. You're not speaking the same language as me. I don't understand why you're telling me these things. But he knew. He knew something was different within me because he had been drinking for a little bit. And he saw what it did to me right away. And, you know, I got into a lot more trouble in grammar school when I like this story because it just shows how, like, insane my life is. When I was in 8th grade, I don't know if anyone, when they graduate grammar school or high school, they get yearbooks. We get yearbooks, and in my neighborhood, we all sign things in it, like, you know, like, hey, great 8 years of school, have fun in high school, you're the best. Me and my friends decided we're going to write every single thing that we did wrong in our yearbooks. It basically became like a fourth step in the yearbooks. Like, we did a searching and fearless moral inventory in the yearbooks while in class. One teacher came over and sees it, And it's like, well, we now need to have a meeting with the principal. And we're going to need to see your parents. My searching and fearless moral inventory quickly became a fifth step. And I admitted to my principal, to my mom, and to my eighth grade teacher the exact natures of my wrongs. And it was uncomfortable. I got like four sentences in, and the first thing I wrote down, and it's like me sitting here, the principal, the teacher, my mom. It was horrible. And there was things in there that I can't say from a podium, and definitely things that I would never say to my mother unless I had to. And I'm like four sentences in, and I just get punched square in my face by my mom. And I was like, this is hysterical. Like, the teachers are freaking out because parents shouldn't hit kids. I'm freaking out because I don't know how they didn't expect me to get hit there. I'm like, come on, like, I deserve this wholeheartedly. Like, did you hear what I just said? But I didn't know how to behave at all from the earliest age. And like 2 weeks later, I'm supposed to be graduating, and the valedictorian of my school's name was Sean Gallen. And during the huge mass and the huge ceremony, that nun who saw my mom punch me in the face 2 weeks earlier gets up there. And she's like, and you know, the class of 2000 valedictorian, Sean O'Connor. And I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest moment of my life. This nun starts hysterically crying on the altar, like so upset because she just embarrassed me. When the truth is, I loved it. You know, I gave a quick wave, like didn't expect to win this. And, you know, she came up to me later on. And she was like, I can't believe I did that to you and your family. You've been in my prayers these past 2 weeks because I knew how much trouble you were in and how much things you were doing and how much pain you were in. And I never knew until I got to recovery how much harms I've totally done to the people I came in contact with. Like, I thought that was just a funny thing that happened to her and she felt bad. She was crying in front of an audience because she thought she made me look bad. Like, that's the effect I have on people at the earliest of ages. You know, that's the way I am. I harm people when I come in contact with them if I have no real solution in my life. Without fail, every time. And, you know, I had this experience of getting into all this trouble. So my parents sent me to a nice private school in the city for high school. My first geographic at the age of 14. And, you know, the same things happened. I followed the trouble followed me. It wasn't the other people. I went there first day of freshman orientation with every intention of being a good student, with being like starting over, getting this second chance. And what happened was the one kid who I did know was a senior at that school. He came in. He said, "Where's Sean O'Connor?" And I was like, "Oh God!" And it starts. I went out for lunch, had a few drinks. You know, the next day that blazer I was wearing wasn't there anymore. You know, my hair was no longer combed. It started all over again. And high school was uneventful, you know. Alcohol was working. I was having a blast. I made friends, had a great time. And then, you know, when college came around and all my friends started going away to schools, and I tried to do that, but they didn't want me, so I stayed local. And I found out what alcohol really could do for me. I really had an experience with alcohol for the first time that was like none other. I was drinking by myself, and I was okay with it. I was able to drink whatever I wanted, do whatever I wanted, and not have to worry about all these repercussions that come from this. And I had a good experience with it. I really did. Alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. It made life more bearable. It made whatever I was going through more bearable. I had some fun. And then, I had this experience driving a car really, really fast, really, really early in the morning, like 9 a.m., and I totaled this thing, like, bad. And it was the first time I had this wake-up call that I should not be drinking the way I'm drinking. That there might be something wrong here. I'm 20 years old. I started out driving in a car, and now it's in two pieces. And I decided at that moment that I'm no longer drinking alcohol. That I'm done with this. Because something really bad is going to happen to me or someone else. And like 3 days later, I went to the impound lot to get all the stuff that was out of the car. And someone came up to me that was working there. And they go, "We got told that someone who crashed a car here died." said, we have to ask, was it the person that was in this car? Because this car just got destroyed. And, like, somehow, the way my thinking is, I was like, this is a green light, you know? I'm invincible. I can do whatever I want. They assumed the person that died was driving this car, and it was me. And I walked away unscathed. I had, like, a tiny scratch on my chin. And I took that to mean do whatever you want. Have as much fun as you want. Nothing is going to happen to you. And that night I went out drinking. You know, that oath I said, where I said, I'm not touching this stuff anymore. I'm going to die. Like, knowing I'm going to die at some point because of this thing, 3 days later, I'm drinking because they told me they thought someone died. And I didn't. And that's how my mind works. I'll believe anything to get me drinking again. And, you know, there's just like 3 more years of drinking. Nothing that crazy happened. You know, seriously, there is nothing besides like all those things that like really were the warning signs. And I just kept getting into trouble. And I had one of those months in December of 2008. Where I decided, like, it was just, you know, hospital, arrest, hospital. And it was, like, a month of it. And, like, you know, it was just people, like, regular drinkers have, like, a bad night. Alcoholics have, like, bad months. And I had one of those months where it was just, like, I gotta stop this. And I made that promise again. I'm done. Like, I can't do this. And this time I lasted. It was 3 months. And I was circling the calendar every day, putting a circle at the start of the day, putting an X at the end of the day. Like, I'm done, I'm doing this, white-knuckling it, going crazy. Absolutely crazy. Because what I was doing was, I was treating alcoholism, but had it misdiagnosed as a drinking problem. And if I'm treating alcoholism with the delusion that all I'm suffering from is a drinking problem, it's gonna go really badly. And it always has for me. Because for a guy like me, if you take away alcohol, my real problem starts. You know, drinking's never been my problem. I mean, it's been a problem. But, like, it's definitely been a problem. But the alcoholism, that's the real problem. You know, my sponsor would always say, alcohol comes in a bottle. Alcoholism, that's inside you. And I believe that. Because I took away alcohol, and I still felt this. You know, I still felt this uncomfortability. In fact, after a while, it got worse. You know, in Bill's story, he has this one line that I think sums up sobriety for me. Gradually, things got worse. Like, that was my experience. Whenever I took alcohol away from me without substituting it with a greater solution, gradually, things got worse. Sometimes it might be a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but eventually, the progressiveness of my disease was that my sobriety got more and more uncomfortable all the time. And in March of 2009, I went on one last run. And what started it was just not being happy. You know, if I'm uncomfortable and unhappy in my sobriety, I know where I go to. And it's not a good place. And it's without fail. Whenever I start to feel this unease of being sober, I end up doing it. And on that like Tuesday or Wednesday, I made the decision that weekend, because I'm going to Cleveland, I can drink. I'm going with 3 friends who I know really well, so it's going to be okay if I drink. And what happened was I went there, and I drank for 3 days, which is nothing new. I didn't sleep at all. I didn't eat anything. And nothing terrible happened. Like, it was just one of those weekends. Except on the way home, I felt different. Like, I knew I couldn't do this alone. And prior to this drinking after, like, 80 days with nothing, I was at a bar. And because I would do that in my sobriety, or not sobriety, I would do that when I'm not an Alcoholics Anonymous, not trying to drink. And I had an ex-girlfriend who was an ex at the time, who was dating her new boyfriend that she's still dating today. And I felt that I should be the best ex-boyfriend possible and show up to her birthday party at the bar because, you know, I had to show up to her birthday party. And I've actually been to more of her birthday parties as an ex-boyfriend than I did when I was dating her, which is not a good sign, which is probably why she's still dating that other guy now. But I showed up to this bar, absolutely miserable. Like, worst feeling in the world, totally self-imposed, all me. Like, just showing up to do, like, I don't know. Like, looking for resentments everywhere I turned. And, it sucked. And, but during it, her best friend, this girl who I think is, like, the most beautiful girl in the entire world, the sweetheart, she may have had one too many drinks, and she was chatting me up nonstop. And my ego starts going right away, thinking this means something it doesn't mean. And it didn't mean it. And I'm sitting there chewing on ice cubes, looking insane. Like, sitting at a bar, miserable. Everyone's around me having fun. And I'm just chewing on, like, glass after glass of ice cubes. And this girl's talking to me. And right away I start thinking, all right, this isn't that bad. Like, I'm doing all right. Like, she's talking to me nonstop. I'm feeling good. She's like, hey, Sean, you want to go outside and smoke a cigarette? And I'm like, yeah, of course I want to go outside and smoke a cigarette. I had stopped smoking cigarettes like 7 years prior to that. But she could have asked me any question at all. And I was like, yes, I want to go do that. What, you want me to go outside and strangle kittens? Yeah, I want to do that. Like, of course I do. I would have said anything to go outside with her. And we go outside, and she's like, why are you doing this? I'm like, what? What do you mean? Why am I doing what? I'm hanging out, having a great time with my friends. It's my ex-girlfriend's birthday. What do you mean, why am I doing this? She goes, why are you not going to AA already? She goes, my dad and my brother have both been sober for a long time. You don't have to do this anymore. See, guys, I believe God takes many different sizes and forms. I do. One of the biggest delusions I have is I think I know what shape and size God's going to show up in. That night he spoke to me in a 22-year-old girl who had too much to drink, but at the time she had no idea she was saving someone's life. I honestly believe that. I don't know if I ever would have known about Alcoholics Anonymous if she had not told me that night. You know, I was just willing enough, led by the wrong motives and the wrong principles, to get delivered the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew her older brother. He was a terrifying person. He still is. Golden Glove boxer. She goes, call my brother Matt. Absolutely not. Like, absolutely not. Tell him I was hanging out with you? No, thank you. You know, like, I've seen him beat up people for nothing at all. Like, I used to fight a lot, and I was not good at it. Like, this finished product before you, 6'2", 160 pounds, was like 6'2", 130 when I got sober. Like, I had a big mouth. I was quick to use my hands. But very rarely did I ever want to fight. And this kid did. Like, he's what I wanted to be, basically. Like, a small kid who could just throw down really well. That's what I dreamed of being. She's like, yeah, give him a call. I was like, nah, not doing it. Definitely not doing it. And I didn't. I didn't for a couple of months. And then that happened in March of 2009. I went on one last three-day run. And on St. Patrick's Day of 2009, I went into work after this run. And my boss goes to me, hey, Sean, drop off your car. And he goes, drop me off at the parade, drop off your car. Enjoy St. Patty's Day. Which would have been the greatest words anyone could have ever told me any other year. But I was terrified that day. I was terrified of drinking. I wasn't afraid it was going to kill me. I was afraid it was going to keep being exactly how it was. Like, death was a welcomed idea. You know, if I could have died and had it look like a tragedy and not made my parents, like, terribly, terribly upset of something I did at my own hands, I would have signed up for it. But being afraid of putting them through that is why I didn't do it. But if it just happened, and like, everyone would feel bad. You know, like, we have those, like, fake funerals in our heads where, like, I wonder how many people would show up to my funeral. You know, I bet that wake would be a lot of fun. Like, that's how, I mean, you guys never really thought that way. You never really had the fake funerals in your head? I had them a lot. So I was afraid of it. I was afraid of living the way I was living. And after staring at the phone for 2 hours, I called the kid. You know, I was like, dude, I just got back from being on a run. Like, I don't know what to do. I can't stop drinking. I'll put together sometime, and I'm absolutely miserable. Like, I hate being sober. I hate being drunk. You know, life sucks drinking. Life sucks sober. Well, it sounds like you got the first step, you know. We got this death sentence, you know, unless I do something drastic about it. He goes, why don't you come back into the city and meet me for a meeting? Like, all right, you know, what day do you want to do it? It's like, what do you mean, what day do you want to do it? Like, why don't you come in today? Why don't you come meet me now? What do you got going on? I know it's nothing. You just told me your boss gave you the day off. I was like, I guess. I mean, I'm making this life-changing decision to stop drinking for good and for all and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You want me to do it now? He's like, you know, like, we got time for this. I'm like 23 years old. I'm like, let's go. Let's just, like, I'm hoping to live at least to like 70. Like, let's hold off on going to Alcoholics Anonymous just yet. Then it's official. Then I officially have a problem if I go there. My thinking was so messed up for so long. And I met him. And I'll tell you, I had like strollers on in my early recovery. This guy took me everywhere he went. I was terrified to go to meetings. That's why whenever I go to a meeting, I'm welcoming people. I'm saying welcome. I have no idea if it's their first meeting. Because my first meeting, I needed people walking me hand in hand. I was so afraid. I wanted to believe that I was a tough guy. I was terrified of absolutely everything. Walking into a room full of people who are smiling and not drinking, not only did it make me angry, it made me scared. You know, which always came hand in hand for me. But I walked in here. And they have a ton of suggestions to do when you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they just didn't really seem like they were the right fit for me. Like, I believed that it would work for other people, but I'm going to rely on the fear of drinking and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to rely on God or the steps or any of that stuff, because that's not what I want to do. I still want to control and manage my own recovery. And I tried doing that to the point that I told a lot of my friends who were still drinking, when I was like, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous now. I'm not drinking anymore. But don't worry, guys. I'm going to be the same exact person that I was, except I'm not going to drink. And, like, that's the only thing I've been right about. Like, I stayed the same exact person that I was, but without drinking. And that's horrible. Like, I was a terrible person, and I stayed exactly the same, except I had no alcohol to blame it on. I've made so many amends for this ludicrous behavior I've done while sober. There's nothing more painful than going to people that you've only known in Alcoholics Anonymous and making amends for all the absurd actions I've done because of it. Because when I'm not treating this thing daily, when I'm just not drinking, I'm in so much trouble. So much trouble. Time and time again, I've gotten myself into trouble by not drinking and not doing any step work or trusting in any kind of higher power. And like, I've had some benchmarks in my recovery that, like, really allowed me to see things. You know, I had, like, 6 months sober. One of my good buddies, you know, was, like, he just totaled a car or something that wasn't his own car. And, like, he was struggling. He's actually in Philadelphia, which I think is pretty close to, I saw a flyer shirt, so I'm thinking it's pretty close to over here. He totaled a car in Philadelphia after starting drinking in Yonkers. And he's like, dude, I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to get sober. I was like, all right, like, let's go. I've been doing this for, like, 6 months. I got this. I wouldn't know what a step was at all, but I got you. Like, let's come. I'm doing step one and step 12 to the best of my ability and nothing in between. And I bring him to meetings. And he gets linked in with this group that, like, does the steps and, like, really has a strong emphasis on the big book and step work. And I'm sitting there, and I tell this guy the two worst words you can say to an alcoholic, in my opinion. And it's not go drink. I told this guy to slow down. Slow down with your recovery. Slow down. You might get too good too quick. Slow down. Like, I know what I'm talking about. Like, I have no idea what I'm saying at all. And I tell this kid to slow down. And it's all because of resentment. I see this kid getting better, much better than I was. And I'm telling him, slow down. Slow down. Thank God he didn't listen to me. Thank God he didn't listen to me. You know, he just celebrated like 5 years sober, I think. Like, he's not the type of guy that can slow down. No real alcoholic's the type of guy that can slow down. It's a constant thing. And, you know, he told me. He was like, man, you've recovered really well from your physical bottom. Like, you haven't even started to recover from alcoholism, though. Don't confuse the two. Don't confuse recovery from your bottom as recovery from alcoholism. Because I start feeling better physically quickly. I mean, for me, it takes like 2 or 3 days and I'm ready to go again. I start thinking things are all right. Everything starts getting better. And it wasn't, though. And at 9 months sober on Thanksgiving of 2009, where I have like, I don't like talking about this because it's pretty embarrassing in my head for a guy at 24 years old to be behaving this way. But like, I freaked out at a family party and had like a meltdown. Like a big time meltdown at Thanksgiving for no reason at all. Like there was nothing that was going on. I was like upset because everyone's able to drink around me and like no one's asking me how I'm doing. Like no one's asking, are you okay with this? Are you okay with us having a glass of wine at dinner at Thanksgiving? Where like if they did ask me if I was okay with it, I would have flipped out too. You know, that's me, impossible to please all the time. All the time. You're not going to make me happy with what you're doing. Ever. Never. And I had this meltdown, and my mom, man, she's getting a lot of, I'm talking about her a bunch tonight. She goes, Sean, is it possible? Like, I mean, I'm like bawling, hysterically crying, talking about like suicide, being a lunatic. And I never mentioned suicide to her when I was drinking. But 9 months without a drink, and I want to kill myself. And she's like, maybe. Maybe you're making too much a deal about this drinking problem. And maybe you should start drinking again. Because I've never seen you more miserable, more upset, or more crazy than I've seen you in the past 9 months. Like, she knew my solution to my alcoholism better than I did. And of course, at the time, I take huge offense to her saying that, and I storm out. Looking back on it, she was right. You know, she was right. I was so miserable, I'm talking about suicide. Like, gee, like that's me. That's who I am. And that's terrifying. That's terrifying for me. But the willpower of an alcoholic can be really strong at times. You know, it's not enough to keep me away from a drink permanently, but it worked for a bit. The fellowship worked for a bit. The fear worked for a bit until I had enough of it. And at 2 years sober with 1 foot in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and 1 foot out of the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, something happened. I look at it today as God. But I had gotten my buddy a job as a doorman with me, and he was a midnight doorman. And he was going through what we call the evangelical big book stage. You know, I got him the job. I had more time sober than him. And he's telling me everything I'm doing is wrong. Like, everything I'm doing is wrong, and it was pissing me off to no end. You know, like, I wanted to get him fired. Like, I wanted to kill him. But I went with him to a meeting because I wanted to see what he was doing that was so different than all the wrong things I was doing. And they were speaking a language I had never heard before. They were telling me it's not no matter what. You know, don't drink no matter what. They tell me no matter what, you will drink. They tell me if you keep going the way you're going, you're destined to drink, and there's nothing you can do about it on your own power. And man, they pissed me. They pissed me off. You know, they really got me. But they got me enough, and they disturbed me enough on my question of alcoholism that I went back. And I wanted to see what they were talking about. And God, it was annoying. But a few days into, like, kind of bouncing around their meetings, like, listening to what they're saying, going to other meetings and being like trying to sound smart about recovery and tell them these things. Like they be saying one thing and I try and point out exactly what they mean they're saying. Like soaking up all their knowledge like a sponge and just throwing up all over a different meeting like it's my own material, which I've done a lot. I realize something. I realize I can't talk about this stuff. This is an experience I need to have. And I switched sponsors. And I got this guy to sponsor me who took me through the 12 steps. in like a month and a half, 2 months. He sat down with me 4 times a week for 2 hours at a pop. He said, listen, you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough. You need to do this. You need to have an experience with these 12 steps, and you need it quick because you're really losing your mind. And I was. And what happened was I had the coolest experience doing the 12 steps. I made amends to everyone I need to make amends to. I did this fearless and searching moral inventory, and I found out that it was me the whole time, that my problem this whole time was not alcohol, it was me. And it was just freeing. And by going through this process and seeing these things, I recovered from alcoholism, which I didn't think was possible. I didn't know any of this was possible. And I did these things. I went and I made these amends to, I have a couple of really cool amends that I've made, where I made them to my parents, you know, my mom and my dad. And I sat down, I did them together. They tell us not to do that. I don't know. I did. I still wasn't following the suggestions too closely. And I sat down with them for like a 4-hour conversation where we put everything on the table, all my behaviors, all the things that I did that affected them, the financials that they covered for me for lawyer fees and cars, and I paid that back. But during the conversation, my mom turns to me at the end of like 4 hours of more crying. I cried a lot in recovery. Like, I don't like saying it because I still have that idea that I'm not a crier. I cried a lot in recovery. And my mom looks at me, and she goes, I've been wanting to ask you this. Is there anything that I could have done differently as a mother that would have resulted in you not being an alcoholic? I made her carry that shame and that guilt for about 3 years longer than I should have because I was not doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't want to take a look at myself and take a look in the mirror and figure out what it was that I had been doing to everyone around me and everyone that loved me. She carried that with her for so much longer than she had to, and I was able to tell her no. There's absolutely nothing you did. You love me unconditionally, and that's your only job as a parent in my eyes. Unconditionally, you would do whatever you could to allow me to have the life you thought I deserved. But my selfishness and my self-centeredness got in the way of it. And I'm sorry for making you carry that with you for that long. And the next morning, she called me with my dad on the phone. And, like, my parents have a pretty cool life. Like, they're in Hawaii, like, every other weekend, it seems. And they call me, and they go, we needed to tell you this together. We've never been happier or prouder than we are today. We woke up today feeling so much lighter than we ever have before. And it's awesome to see the person that you're becoming. And they knew it was just becoming. Like, it's not the person I became. I'm still in such a process of growing right now. It's painful. And what happened was, I talk about this, the 9-step promises, which are some of the coolest things that we have to offer in Alcoholics Anonymous that are promised to us. They have one line in there that says, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And I thought that was like one of the good promises. Today I look at that as a warning promise. You know, amazed means amazed, and that's it. Amazed does not mean free. Amazed does not mean recovered. It means amazed. Whenever I did anything else in my life that amazed me, I'm instantly thinking, next time it'll be even better. It might be more fun with a different person. Drinking could be better if I do other things with it. That's amazed for me. But amazed with amends looks like, wow, that was a really cool experience. I'm amazed by that result. Every time after this is going to go horribly, horribly wrong, and they're going to want to kill me. That's how amazed feels to me in the amends process. But I really thought it meant recover, and I really thought it meant free. And I didn't think I need to seek out the other people I had harmed. I didn't think I need to make it right with everyone. I didn't think the counties that I owed money to deserved it. They have enough. I don't have that much. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about doing all of it all the time. And I found that out by going through the steps again with a new sponsor who really allowed me to see things in a different way. Because at like 4.5 years sober, I realized I was not being sponsored by anybody. I realized that I was doing this whole thing myself. I looked at the 12-step of Alcoholics Anonymous as a fantastic place to hide. I looked at the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a fantastic weapon, as a fantastic shield. I hid behind sponsorship. I hid behind the Big Book, and I hid behind my behaviors. I did not think that I needed to be accountable to any more human beings. I felt that I had got a connection to God that was so strong and so powerful by going through the steps that I then needed to just work with other people. I thought I was past the point of calling people and checking in. I thought I was past the point of doing my nightly inventory. I thought I was past the point of going to the detoxes or the jails. But I also had this crazy ego that told me how special I was as an alcoholic and how great of a job I was doing, that I needed to start doing steel on steel with a group of guys to talk about how much we're doing. And don't get me wrong, I have had a very cool experience doing that as well. But the first question that we looked at during that was, are you spiritually accountable to a sponsor? And right away, 0-for-1. Right away, no, I'm not at all. And my ego had gotten so big that I'm looking at my home group, which I think is one of the coolest groups out there, and I'm looking around, and there's not a single person in here that's qualified to sponsor me. Like, that's what my head's telling me. I was chairing the meeting, looking out at the room, saying, I would not ask a single person here to sponsor me. I'm in serious trouble when that's going on. I'm in serious trouble. And I had a friend ask me, hey, man, you might want to get a sponsor. And I got in touch with the guy who's my sponsor today, and he showed me a different way of living. It wasn't like this chip on my shoulder, going into other meetings, getting ready to tell them how wrong they're doing things. If something wasn't going the way I thought it should go, or they were reading the steps out of the 12 and 12 instead of the Big Book, I was furious. It's like, that's not the steps, that's a man's opinion on the steps. You know, like, I don't know, like, it's crazy in my eyes. Like, that's not my place to tell them. Is it my personal belief? Yeah, it is. But, like, I don't need to tell them that at their group. And I was doing all these things that put a barrier between me and my fellows. All these things all the time that I was getting separated from the people that cared the most for me. My old home group that carried me through my early stages of recovery, who did whatever they could for me, who really did love me until I loved myself, as cliche as that sounds, I instantly got a resentment at them because they didn't tell me about this life. They didn't tell me about this way of living. When they really did, I just wasn't listening. They really did. I just had my ears closed to it. You know, I was shut off from all of that. But this new sponsor who pointed that out to me, so they may not have carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous that freed you, but they definitely carried you until you got to that message. And I went instantly from being so furious and resentful at these people for doing their best in Alcoholics Anonymous to understanding how sick I can really be. To understand that when I'm running on self-will and when my ego is disguising itself as God, how much trouble I'm really in. And that's really been an eye-opening experience. And I was just talking with Sarah before the meeting about, I'll tie this into my prayer meditation, is what's going on currently in my life today. I'm not in New York, but I'm in this area for like another 12 hours because a few months back, one of my buddies who I've given spiritual consent to gave me a call on like one of those like Tuesday afternoon phone calls, like, hey, man, how's it going? Like, oh, everything's good, you know, just at work. And he hits me with that loaded question, how is your job going? I'm like, I don't know. Like, it's a job. It pays the bills. I don't know. It's just, that's all it is, though. He's like, well, why don't you try praying and meditating to see if that's what you should be doing with your life, to see if that's what your career should be? I'm like, all right, like, I'll take a look at that. And for like 3 weeks, I'm going every morning, every night, and I'm bringing in not like, hey, God, give me a great new job and a great new career. But I'm going to say, hey, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Like, is this what I should be doing with my life right now? Because I wasn't sure. I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing still. But I'm praying and meditating with that every single night. And on Mother's Day of this year, I get offered this opportunity that sounds like a really cool idea to start becoming this asset manager of this company and doing these things. I'm like, wow, like, my prayer meditation it's having some sort of effect. I'm going in to interview for these things. And after a few interviews, I get offered this job. And then they're like, all right, but there's one thing with it, though. All these properties, you know, living in New York and working in New York forever, like, they're all out in North Dakota. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, like, North Dakota. You know, I've never gone outside of Yonkers, basically, for anything. North Dakota. That's where trusting in God and believing in God are two entirely different things. I firmly believe that I was supposed to be doing this and that my prayer and meditation led me in this direction. And I firmly believe that going into it. And then they dropped the North Dakota thing on me. Do I just believe in God or do I trust in God? You know, and I was like, listen, I'm going to have to see North Dakota first before I say yes. And I went out there. I don't know. It's nothing special. It's not what I'm used to at all. But I came back and I said, all right, let's do it. You know, I really felt like I was being directed that way. And I've been out there for a few weeks doing this new job that's a whole new everything. I'm terrified of it. You know, I wish I could say I have 100% trust in God and there's no fear related to it. I think fear is a great thing. I really do. I just can't let it dictate my life at all. I have fear there. I think I'd be insane not to. But, you know, tomorrow morning when I wake up and I get back to New York, the first thing I'm doing is driving to LaGuardia and going on an airplane with no return flight booked. Because that's what I think that my meditation, my prayer led me to. The 11th step does also promise, though, that we may pay for this we may pay for this absurd presumption with all sorts of absurd activities or whatever it is. This could be one of them. I don't know. Time's going to tell. But that's a thing that, like, I have to experience. And one last thing with step 12, and I'll close up with this, is that probably like a year ago now, my younger sister was going through a ton of stuff, stuff meaning alcoholism, and my parents were terrified of like what was happening. And my mom calls me, my dad calls me, and like, listen, Casey is really struggling. And I knew this. Like, I mean, I knew she was alcoholic for a long time. It was obvious. And they're like, she's really, really struggling. We're going to rely on you like we never have before. We're going to need you to step up with this and take the bull by the horns because we have no idea what we're doing. All we know is whatever you've done has started to have an effect. And we're going to need you to step up and do this because we're terrified. We think our daughter is going to die. And, you know, it was a rocky, rocky couple of months. But about 7 months ago, when she had 5 months sober, me and my three buddies were driving out to Montauk with her where she had to go make her amends. You know, now she's coming up on a year, like, next week, I think. And, like, that's been probably one of the coolest experiences I've had while getting sober. Because it really reassured to me all the damage I had done to my family. Because I saw it firsthand. You know, because when you're in it, you have no idea. When I'm in the middle of this, I have no idea what I'm doing. But seeing it from that point of view, and seeing them putting their phone back in bed at night when they go to sleep because they're terrified they're going to get a phone call from the hospital or a jail like they did with me, I got to experience it all over again with a different perspective. And I got to make a different kind of amends to them this time. When I went through the steps again, it wasn't an amends for all the terrible behaviors I had done. I got to give them a thank you. And on my fifth year in recovery, my parents came over with like a huge gift basket because they were just so happy. And I was able to sit there with them and tell them thank you. Just thank you guys for all you've done for me. And I'm so sorry for all I've done for you in the past, but thank you. And please let me know if there's anything I can continue to do to make this relationship even stronger and better. And the relationship we have today, I can't even begin to explain how great I feel. I was talking to my buddy Dermot on the way up here. I think that's been my favorite part of recovery, is seeing my little sister get sober and Alcoholics Anonymous join together a family of six people when only two are alcoholic. Because that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the power of God. Thank you, guys.
Will you please help me thank Sean for speaking here tonight? Before we end our meeting this evening, we do have a special announcement.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. So one of these beautiful things we get to do here is get to witness people come through and day by day get to celebrate anniversaries. And I have the privilege to present a very good friend of mine a coin tonight. I met this gentleman back in October 2012, shortly before both of us were planning on taking a little vacation at Montgomery County's finest hotel. And what this gentleman did for me was one of the people that showed me that if you keep doing this work day by day, that you can do anything with a smile on your face and be happy, joyous, and free. So with an extremely grateful heart and privilege, I'd like to present Kyle with his 3-year coin.
Yeah, I'm just extremely blessed to be here today. I shouldn't. And like being one of the lucky ones and getting to go through this experience has just been amazing. The people in these rooms and the life that I have today. And, you know, like on my 3-year anniversary, like I was doing a lot of like looking at what's going on in my life. And I realized that like I really just scratched the surface of this whole thing. And you know, I'd be nowhere without all the people in these rooms and God. That's one thing that this program did is I put my hand in God's hand. And I just want to thank everybody. So thanks a lot.